when the United Nations parted the land of Israel into a Jewish and an Arab state, when the British decided to leave, and when Israel proclaimed itself a sovereign state on May the 15th, 1948. We're getting the touch of the Master's hand here now.
Just go ahead. I just want to turn that.
All right. And we read Psalm 118, verses 10 and to 12, which I'll read again to set the stage. It says, "All nations compassed me about, but in the name of the Lord I will destroy them. They compassed me about, yea, they compassed me about. But in the name of the Lord I will destroy them. They compass me about like bees. They are quenched as a fire of thorns. For in the name of the Lord I will destroy them." Excuse me, I'm just going to go across here. We have a couple of maps here indicating the Arab invasion of the State of Israel on May the 15th, 1948. The state was just formed and the Arabs pounced. And you can see by the arrows there that Israel was attacked from all sides. And I can remember at that time talking to people that lamented and said, "Well, isn't it a terrible shame that Israel is going to be wiped out?" And of course, Israel was not wiped out. And this was a great surprise to many people.
I don't remember too much in 48.
It gives you an idea of the Arab League since 1945. These are the people, of course, that attacked Israel. And we see Syria with 5.5 million, Iraq with 8 million, Transjordan 2 million, Saudi Arabia 6 million, and on it goes. 3 million Jews against 80 million Arabs. And the Jews won that war. Now, although Israel at that time did not consciously act in the name of the Lord, the Lord was nevertheless with them. And while the world looked on, fully expecting that Israel would be destroyed, the reverse happened. Not only did Israel win that war, but she succeeded in enlarging her borders beyond that which the United Nations was going to allow her to have. She increased her holdings in the Negev, on the Mediterranean coast, around Jerusalem, and in the north. A total of 2,380 square miles was added to the 5,760 square miles granted by the UN partition. Between 1948 and 1967, much progress was taking place in the land. Certainly, Isaiah's prophecy of chapter 35, 1 and 2 was in incipient fulfillment. Where it says, "The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. And the glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God." I visited Israel in 1966, and at that time, the desert had been cultivated down as far as Beersheba. Now, when the initial War of Independence was over, and the restrictions upon the Jews entering was removed, the floodgates of European Jewry were lifted, and the Jews poured into Israel. Here we have Jewish refugees from Arab lands in particular here, May the 15th, 1948 to December the 31st, 1967. And I'll just read a few of these figures. Now these are Jews coming into Israel. From Lebanon, 4,000. From Syria, 4,500. From Iraq, 124,647. From Egypt, 37,000 plus. From Libya, 34,000 plus. From Algeria, 13,000 plus. From Morocco, 252,000. From Tunisia, 46,000. So you can see that the scriptures are being fulfilled to the letter in this respect, and yet we realize that this is just the beginning of the grand influx of Jews to that land. Then we come to Europe. The return of the Jews to Zion, 1948 to 1964. I won't read all these figures, but there were thousands of them coming from Spain, France, Poland, Germany, Austria, Hungary, Yugoslavia, and virtually every nation in Europe. Isaiah, in chapter 48 and 10, said, "Behold, I have refined thee, but not with silver. I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction." And out of that furnace they came, just as Isaiah had prophesied. And in chapter 31, starting at verse 7, we read these verses. Keep in mind that we are looking at an initial fulfillment of a much greater ingathering after the Gogian invasion. Nevertheless, I should say that this initial fulfillment was very impressive to those of us who were watching in 1948, 49, and 50, which I and many of us here had the privilege to do. At that time, 684,000 Jews fled to Israel. And here is the quotation. It says, "For thus saith the Lord, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations. Publish ye, praise ye, and say, O Lord, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I bring them from the north. I will bring them from the north country, and gather them from the coast of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame, and the woman with child, and her that travaileth with child together, a great company shall return thither." We actually saw pictures at that time of boatloads of people being unloaded, some of them on crutches, some of them being led off, some of them being carried off. Israel's policy was that they would refuse no Jewish person, and I think that is still true, that regardless of their ability to look after them, anyone who is Jewish wishing to come to Israel is welcomed with open arms. Then continuing on, "They shall come with weeping, and with supplication will I lead them. I will cause them to walk by the rivers of water in a straight way, wherein they shall not stumble. For I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Hear the word of the Lord, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather him, and will keep him as a shepherd doth his flock. For the Lord hath redeemed Jacob, and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he." And as I say, in 1948, etc., this was the beginning of the return. And when our Lord returns and the Gogian invasion takes place and that is consummated, then we will see the final magnificent return of all the Jews to their own land. Now, while Isaiah 31 was being fulfilled, another prophecy contained in Isaiah 6 was in operation, and I'd like to start at verse 9. And he said, go tell this people, speaking of Israel, go tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed. Then said I, O Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. And the Lord have removed men far away, and there be a great a great forsaking in the midst of the land. Now these verses, in a nutshell, describe the scattering of Israel. But in verse 13, we have a description of the initial regathering and the condition that will prevail during the time of that regathering. It says, but yet in it shall be a tenth, and it shall return, and shall be eaten as a teal tree, and as an oak, whose substance is in them when they cast their leaves. So the holy seed shall be the substance thereof. Now this is a hard verse to understand. I looked at it a long, long time, and over at various times. But if we use all the marginal notes that we have there, and if we leave out all the italicized words, this is how it sounds. But yet in it, a tenth, when it is returned, and hath been browsed as a teal tree, and as an oak, whose stalk or stem is in them when they cast, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof. Now, we have the reference to a teal tree, which is similar to a terebinth tree, and it refers to the characteristic of that tree, that when it casts its seed, there are stems and leaves that are attached to the seed, and they come off with the seed. This is a low-growing tree, and animals such as cattle can reach up and browse the seed from the tree. Now, what we are being told here is that when one-tenth of the nation of Israel has returned to the land, as was the case in 1951, they would be subject to a browsing which occurred at the hand of the Arab terrorist and has continued even unto this day. This nibbling, you might say, or the browsing of the nation. And here I have a very interesting map. Here we have terrorist raids into Israel between 1951 and 1956. It's amazing that these raids started in 1951 at a time when the population of Israel was 10% of the total Jewish nation. And these terrorists were called Fedayeen, and they were out of Egypt. And the bulk of their activities lasted from 1951 to 1956. And I'll read just a few of the figures. Of the we have a year and the source of the raid and the number of Israeli dead. So in 1951, there was from Jordan 111 killed, from Egypt 26. 1952, from Jordan 114, from Egypt 48. 1953, from Jordan 124, Egypt 38. 1954, Jordan 117, Egypt 50. 1955, Jordan 37, Egypt 241. Just imagine that, of a small nation, and these terrorists coming into the nation and killing They killed men, women, and children. There was no one was spared. And it was very, very insidiously done. 1951 to 55 from Syria, 55 Israelis were killed, and from Lebanon, 6. So this was a very specific fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 6 in this respect. Ezekiel 20, starting at verse 34, in my opinion, describes this browsing with the term the wilderness of the people. It says, I will bring you out from the people and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out, and I will to the wilderness of the people. And there will I plead with you face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So will I plead with you, saith the Lord God. Ancient Israel contended with a literal wilderness. Modern Israel contended with a wilderness of Arab terrorism. There was a certain amount of Arab terrorism, even against ancient Israel. You can recall, I believe, how the Amalekites attempted to attack their rear section of the nation as they traveled through the wilderness. And prophecy of Obadiah singles them out for that very thing. We're not going to go into that right now. 44 years have passed since 1948, and the majority of those who were the leaders who were 20 years old and over have died. The pioneers, Ben Gurion, Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, Menachem Begin, and others have passed into history, never to rise again, while the Lord continues to plead with the surviving generation. Now that brings us to the end of our lesson, and it brings us now to our last lesson, which I suspect will be completed tomorrow, under the title of What Does the Future Hold? And here I will say at the very beginning that much of what I'm going to say could be wrong. And someone might say, well, that's not new. Nevertheless, we must talk about it. I think this is part of the message of Malachi, where a blessing is to be derived upon those who spoke to one another about these things. Psalm 102, beginning at verse 13, says, Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her is come. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones and favor the dust thereof. So the heathen shall fear the name of the Lord, and all the kings of the earth thy glory. When the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. This is one of the great signs. Well, what does it mean when the Lord shall build up Zion? Does it mean Mount Zion? Does it mean Jerusalem? Does it mean the nation of Israel? I think that it means the nation of Israel. We are now in the 47th year since the United Nations divided Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. We're in the 46th year since the sovereign state of Israel was declared. Our Lord has not yet appeared in his glory. Nevertheless, Zion continues to be built up. Deuteronomy 4, verses 27 to 31, gives us something else to think about. It says, And the Lord shall scatter you among the nations, and ye shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. And there ye shall serve gods, the work of men's hands of wood and stone. which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. But if from thence thou shalt seek the Lord thy God, thou shalt find him, and if thou seek him with all thine heart and with all thine soul. When thou art in tribulation, and all these things are come upon thee, even in the latter days, this is the significance, in the latter days, if thou turn to the Lord thy God, and shall be obedient unto his voice, for the Lord thy God is a merciful God, he will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee, nor forget the covenant of thy fathers which he sware unto thee. Now, at this point in time, Israel, whether in the land or in the diaspora, does not seek God in any national sense. Even during the Holocaust, few Jews acknowledged that the persecution they were suffering had anything to do with their own sin. Now, I mentioned the other day, and I'll just repeat it quickly, that when I was in Israel in 1966, an Austrian Jewish guide that we had told us that at that time there were three types of Jews in Israel. There were those Jews who were the Orthodox synagogue type that really had no great interest in the state. They simply wanted to be left at peace to worship and carry on in the synagogue. There was the second group who were agnostic and atheist, who were in Israel for safety, because there were they fled out of Europe, and Israel would give them safety, and religion was not imposed upon them. And finally, the third group was that group of Jews who recognized that the hand of God was in their destiny and was operative, but they didn't understand how it was working. Now, none of these groups understood their history or the nature of their persecution, nor did they search the scriptures in any sincere effort to seek God. The atheists, of course, had no interest. The Orthodox thought they knew it all, and while the rest, it would appear, wanted the knowledge handed to them on a platter. We know, brothers and sisters, that the knowledge of salvation is contained in the Bible, but we have to dig it out ourselves. Even in the time of Christ, he didn't pester people to serve the Lord and to understand his message. They had to go to him. And it is true today. We have to come to Christ in the Bible and to God in the Bible if we wish to have the knowledge of salvation. Once again, we remember the words of the Apostle Paul in Romans 11, verses 25 to 27, which this has been discussed a number of times this week, and it's an important subject, very current, where the Apostle says, I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion a deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. Well, the question is then, friends and brethren, when is that point of time when the fullness of the Gentiles will have come in? When, or put it another way, when will the return of Christ take place? And the precise answer, of course, is that no one knows. For as Christ in Mark chapter 13, verse 32 remarked, but of that day and that hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. On the other hand, we read the words of Hebrews chapter 10, verses 23 to 25, where it says, let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching. And thus, although we do not know the day nor the hour, we are nevertheless, through the witness of Israel, fully able to see that day approaching. We have also, as the Apostle Peter reminded us in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19, a more sure word of prophecy, whereunto ye do well to take heed, as a light that shineth in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star arise in our hearts. Utilizing, therefore, this more sure word of prophecy, we recall the great seven times prophecy recorded in Leviticus chapter 26, which we touched on a day or so ago, where four times the Lord said, I will punish you seven times for your sins. In this chapter also, we have a conditional promise, which we touched on, but I think it's worthy of review. Speaking of Israel, the Lord states, if they shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers with their trespass, which they trespassed against me, and that also they have walked contrary unto me, and that I also walked contrary unto them, and have brought them into the land of their enemies. If then their uncircumcised hearts be humbled, and they accept the punishment of their iniquity, then will I remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land. Now, the seven times is a period of time also dealt with in Daniel chapter 4, where Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great tree, which was hewn down, and the stump banded with bands of brass and with iron. And this was for a period of seven times. In his book, Light for the Last Days, written by the late Grattan Guinness and published in 1888, Mr. Guinness states, here, therefore, we take for granted what has been abundantly proved by many godly and learned writers, and what we ourselves also in a former work demonstrated, and assume the following conclusions. And I'm only going to read one of the conclusions, which the Christadelphians are interested in. He says that in symbolic prophecy, a day is the symbol of a year and a time 360 years. And this has been the basis of Christadelphian interpretation of prophecy. Seven times, then, is a period of 2,520 years, also known as the times of the Gentiles. The historic difficulty has been to know when this period commenced. It was Jesus who used the term, the times of the Gentiles, in Luke 21 and 24, where he said, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, thus the times of the Gentiles is defined by the treading down of the city of Jerusalem by the Gentiles. Now, historically speaking, the treading down of Jerusalem by the Gentiles started with the Babylonian captivity. This captivity started in about 606 BC when Daniel was taken captive to Babylon, but it was not until about 586 BC that the temple was destroyed and the captivity completed. And thus we have a 20-year initiating period wherein at some point the 2,520-year period was to commence. Well, our next clue comes from Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great image. This was a representation of world empires of the from the time of Nebuchadnezzar until the coming of Christ. This also is a representation of the times of the Gentiles. It started with the head of gold. In Daniel 2:38, the prophet states to Nebuchadnezzar, "Thou art this head of gold." Grattan Guinness again writes, "It was in the year 606 that Nebuchadnezzar first came against Judah and carried Daniel and the Hebrew children, among others, captive. At this time, he was acting on behalf of his father, and it was not until nearly 2 years later, in 604 B.C., that he himself acceded to the throne. That year is consequently, properly speaking, the first of Nebuchadnezzar, and it was probably also the year in which he saw the vision of the great image." Now, the scripture says that it was in his second year that he saw it. Now, it could be one day after the after the beginning of the second year. So, in this aspect, there is a little fuzziness at the edges, you might say. He says that year is consequently, properly speaking, the first of Nebuchadnezzar, and was probably also the year in which he saw the vision of the great image, in connection with which it was said, "Thou art this head of gold." Now, this year has therefore some special claims to be considered as a very principal starting point of the times of the Gentiles. And end of quote. Now, with the starting point of 604, the addition of 2520 brings us to 1917, which, of course, we're all familiar with it. A year when General Allenby captured Jerusalem from the Turk and initiated the beginning of the end of Gentile times. It was also, of course, the year of the Balfour Declaration, which we read yesterday. Grattan Guinness wrote, "But there can be no question that those who live to see the year 1917 will have reached one of the most important, perhaps the most momentous, of these terminal years of crisis." Indeed, this was the most momentous year in the history of the Christadelphians up to that point in time. Now, to give you an idea of just what an impact that 1917 made on the Christadelphians, I should like to read an excerpt from an article in the Christadelphian Advocate of 1969, written by our late sister Sarah Ferrer. I asked Sister Ferrer to write this article. She had made a tape of it previously, but I thought that here was a sister whose lifetime extended back into the 1800s and who was a living witness of much of what went on. So here's what she had to say in part. We have all heard much about the Balfour Declaration, issued on November the 2nd, 1917, which viewed with favor the establishment of a national home for Jewish people in Palestine. But hearing about it can never impart the thrill of actually seeing the headlines in the paper for the first time. There was no radio or television in those days. But this thrill, November 1917, was completely eclipsed the next month when Lord Allenby, the British Field Marshal, took Jerusalem in December of 1917, and the Turks were completely routed and driven bag and baggage out of Palestine. This not only brought to pass the expected bringing of the British into Palestine, and you remember that we read from Elpis Israel a day or so ago that our brother John Thomas had interpreted prophecy to suggest that the British would be highly instrumental in Palestine. And Sister Ferrer is saying that here it is, it's just as he said. This not only brought to pass the expected bringing of the British into Palestine, but completed the long-watched prophecy of Revelation 16 and 12 of the drying up of the river Euphrates as far as the land of Israel was concerned. It would be impossible for me to even try to tell you how the Brotherhood felt at that time. I think I can say that there was not an alert Christadelphian in the world who did not feel exactly the same, as though an angel had spoken to them with a direct message. Long-distance telephone calls were rare in those days, but brethren called long distance to speak to one another out of the fullness of their hearts. No event since that time, not even June 1967, has produced the same pitch of emotion. Brother Sargent, in the July 1967 Christadelphian magazine, draws attention to the change between the profound emotion which the Brotherhood in 1917 greeted the Balfour Declaration and the capture of Jerusalem, and the comparative placidity of many in the present day. I can vouch for the truth of this statement. So this is what our late sister Sadie Farrer had to say as she watched these events come to pass. In the 12th chapter of Daniel, the prophet sees a vision in which he sees a river. On each side of the river, there is a man standing, and a third man standing on the waters of the river, presumably in the middle of the river. The river apparently represents the times of the Gentiles, and the question is asked in verse 6, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? The answer given in verse 7 is a time times and a half, or 3.5 times, which is one half of the 7 times period, which is 1260 years. Now, if the end of these wonders is the end of Gentile times, it would seem logical then that if we measure back from 1917, 1260 years, we should arrive at a significant date. And that date would be the year 657 A.D. Well, it so happens, and I don't... It's what I'm going to tell you seems to be significant. Whether it is or not, I can't prove it. But in the year 657 was the first year of Pope Vitellianus. Now, remember, we started with the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. Now we're in a position in the midpoint. We're starting with the first year of Pope Vitellianus. And in his book, The Approaching End of the Age, Grattan Guinness indicates that in the year 663, which was 6 years into the reign of Pope Vitellianus, it says, Pope Vitellianus enjoined the exclusive use of the Latin tongue in the offices of divine worship throughout Christendom, thus completing the development of the Latin or Roman Church. Now, having determined two significant terminal dates in the 3.5 time period, we can with some confidence do what Brother Alan Laird of Ottawa did and add the 75-year time extension given in Daniel to 1917. Daniel 12 and 11 states, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now this rendering, according to Dr. Thomas, is a little misleading, and he said it should be expressed as follows. And at the time of vengeance, the daily shall be taken away in order to set up an abomination that maketh desolate 1,290 days. Now, Dr. Thomas is suggesting that there is an interval of time between the taking away of the daily sacrifice and the setting up of the abomination that maketh desolate. Now, the 1,290 years may be divided into a period of 1,260 years, the 3.5 times, and an extension of 30 years. Now, if we consider that the 1,260-year period ended in 1917, the addition of 30 years would bring us to 1947, at which year, of course, the United Nations divided the land of Palestine into Jewish and Arab sections. This brings to mind the prophecy of Joel, chapter 3, verse 2, which contains the phrase, "and parted my land." Verse 12 of Daniel adds a further extension of time. "Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,335 days," bringing this down, breaking this down into its basic parts. We have 1,260 years plus 30 years plus 45 years, and converting these to dates, we have 1917, 1947, and 1992. But the year 1992 is now past, and nothing significant has happened. We operate on what is known as the Julian calendar, which was not known, of course, in the times of Daniel. And thus, December the 31st, 1992, is not a precise terminal point, prophetically speaking. The Jewish secular year runs from September the 28th, 1992, to September the 16th, 1993. Now, we're not sure that this is the precise scale either, but I think we're in a rather small ballpark. This means that the Balfour Declaration and the defeat of the Turkish power would have occurred in the same Jewish year, and the parting of the land and the declaration of statehood of Israel would have been in the same Jewish year. And we may be greatly encouraged that the 75th year of prophetic extension may not run out until September the 16th of this year. You know, it says hope springs eternal in the human breast, and I don't think we can be criticized for continuing to hope this way as long as we are continuing to watch. Well, that just happens to be a nice stopping place for the moment.